Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 14th of August, these are our main stories. There have been scuffles at Hong Kong International Airport between police and anti-government protesters after a second day of disruption to flights. Close relatives of two prominent Saudis being held in detention have publicly spoken of their alleged mistreatment. The Danish Prime Minister has apologised to hundreds of victims of abuse in state-run children's homes, describing it as one of the darkest chapters in Denmark's history. Also in this podcast,
the fact that we've got to this point after over 20 years of politicians and scientists discussing climate change, it shows that we need a huge intervention.
In a bid to help tackle climate change, a British university is banning beef. First, there were angry confrontations between riot police and protesters shortly before midnight local time at Hong Kong International Airport. They marked a second day of disruption of one of Asia's busiest hubs. Television pictures showed police at one point trying to push their way into the building and then leaving. Protesters rushed to barricade the entrances. One police officer was cornered by a group of protesters armed with batons.
Oh my God!
These protesters, Katie and Helen, were inside the building.
We saw riot police pressing, like charging in the airport, and they have used pepper sprays against the protesters.
We did see quite a lot of protesters blocking the departure hall,
but then the airport authority staff did not show up and actually didn't at all offer assistance to the affected tourists.
I think the main goal of today's action is that the protester would like to paralyze the operation of the airport in order to pressurize the government because the five demands are not answered up to now.
Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, has warned protesters they're pushing the city into an abyss. Beijing says it'll crush the unrest in Hong Kong with an iron fist. I've been speaking to our correspondent at the airport, Jonathan Head.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you couldn't believe the scenes that we saw here earlier. I mean, yesterday was a very busy day where the protesters had come in such numbers that they forced the airport to shut down. But the mood was still quite lighthearted, and it was very optimistic with the protesters going around trying to persuade passengers, apologising and persuade them to accept the reasons they'd done it. Today was much tenser. It was a much more militant mood. There were far more protesters up here where I am on the departure lounge. They completely controlled it. They brought luggage trolleys together in these impressive improvised barricades and completely blocked the departures channel, and making it effectively impossible for passengers to get on. They also barricaded at one point the entrances to the airport because we actually had riot police arriving and lining up in a fairly intimidating fashion outside the glass. There were some very, very ugly moments where these very on-edge protesters discovered among them people they say are infiltrators. There were three men we saw almost lynched. Very, very hectic, emotional scenes. They were beaten in some cases. They say they found identity cards on them, marking them as mainland Chinese police officers. And then there was a police delegation that came into the airport to try to rescue them. And this entire crowd of thousands of protesters was just screaming abuse at them. It was very, very emotional. Everybody thought that the riot police would come in this time. The protesters had totally taken control of the airport this time. It didn't happen. Suddenly the protesters, as they did yesterday, just melted away. The question is, what are they going to do next? Are they going to try this again? Will the Hong Kong authorities find some way to try to stop them coming in? It's very easy to get into this airport from the train. If they do keep doing this, what will the government do? At the moment, the police are unable to come in here and take control of the most important gateway for this city-state. You know, it's really hard to imagine how long a government can put up with this. And of course, the longer the Hong Kong government looks impotent like this, you have to worry that China will make good the threats it keeps making to intervene?
Because, as you say, Jonathan, everyone expected the response today to be even more heavy-handed than it was, and the authorities held back. If the protesters come back tomorrow or at the weekend, at some point, the authorities are going to have to step up the level of response required to deal with the situation.
That's what I would think too, but it is very difficult in an airport terminal. Every time the services are suspended, you've got hundreds and hundreds of trapped passengers, many of whom can't afford hotels, so they're all sleeping, you know, behind the check-in desks. You know, you can't have an operation with tear gas and pepper spray and panicking protesters in huge numbers. The risk of a stampede today, had they come in, and of people being trampled, was very high. And in the midst of that, you've got families with children who are just caught here, who are flying on somewhere else. I think the authorities are in a very difficult position.
Jonathan Head, our correspondent at the airport in Hong Kong. The families of two prominent critics of the Saudi regime, both being held in prison, have gone public to accuse their captors of mistreatment. The siblings of a women's rights activist say she's been offered her freedom if she publicly denies she's been tortured. Separately, the son of a reformist cleric says his father faces execution on what he calls trumped-up charges. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher told me more about these cases, starting with the latest development on the women's rights campaigner.
Yes, Lujain Al-Haflul is a very well-known figure inside Arabia and outside, actually, as well. She was something which once didn't exist, a social media star in Saudi Arabia, and she used her influence to advocate for women's rights. She's been arrested several times during the campaign to give women the right to drive. She was arrested, but she is currently in prison, having been detained more than a year now, May last year. And she's been charged, along with several other women activists, for trying to destabilize the country, essentially for talking to hostile entities, people like you and me, journalists, who are trying to tell the story about what's happening there. Now, her family, her brother and sister, have said that she's been offered a deal. The deal is, one, that she signs a document saying that she's not been tortured, despite allegations that she has. But two, and this is where the family has drawn the line, and she has for now, that she does it on video, on camera. And they've said, this is a line we're not going to cross. Though, interesting, I've just been looking at some of her supporters who've said, for heaven's sake, just do it. Save yourself the trouble. We know that it's not true. You've suffered enough.
And tell me about the reformist cleric who's been in prison for 2 years.
Yes, the opposite pole. Salman Al-Huda was once a real firebrand. I mean, he was very, very hardline Islamist. He changed over the past 15 years or so. He became an advocate for much more moderate interpretation of Islam. One of the kind of figures that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman you would have thought would be encouraging, because he has said that that's the Islam that he wants Saudi Arabia to follow now. But he's been in prison for more than 2 years, accused essentially of mocking Saudi Arabia, mocking the government. Now, he's in an even more serious position than Lujain Al-Haflul is. He could be executed on the charges that he faces. And his son has just written two articles for The Guardian here and The New York Times in America, expressing his concern, both the way he's been treated, held in solitary confinement, beaten, but the fact that on what he calls, the son calls Abdullah, trumped up charges, he could, before the end of this year, be executed. Very, very serious concern. Interesting, these two figures from opposite poles advocating reform. And while they've been in prison, some of that reform has actually been happening. So there's an irony in that.
Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher. The new Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen has given a formal apology to hundreds of victims of historical child abuse in state-run children's homes. A television documentary in 2005 detailed children at one orphanage being sexually abused. Merlin Thomas reports.
Meeting dozens of tearful victims at her official residence, the Prime Minister called the abuse one of the darkest chapters in Denmark's history. An official inquiry found the children were sexually abused, beaten and drugged at the homes across Denmark for over 26 years. Campaigners battled tirelessly against official indifference. Although a subsequent inquiry found abuse at 19 homes, successive governments said the cases were too old to be pursued. One of the victims told the BBC, "The apology means everything. All we wanted was peace of mind."
Merlin Thomas reporting. The Kremlin has dismissed suggestions that mass protests in Moscow in the past few weeks are a sign of a political crisis in Russia. A presidential spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, also defended the Kremlin's recent silence on the demonstrations, saying it wasn't their business to comment on the behaviour of either the police or the protesters. From Moscow, here's Sarah Rainsford.
The Kremlin is keen to play down these Moscow protests. In his first comments on the issue, the spokesman Dmitry Peskov told the BBC that this is no political crisis. To others, he said these events were nothing out of the ordinary. So Vladimir Putin, busy today discussing road building in Crimea and visiting the ballet, has no need to comment on them. And yet, these are the most sustained, largest protests here in years. And the scale and force of the clampdown suggests officials are concerned. Police violence has been fueling public anger even further. On that, Mr. Peskov said that a tough response to what he called public disorder was absolutely justified, though the disproportionate use of force was unacceptable and being investigated. But that's an internal process by the police. Meanwhile, more than a dozen protesters are facing up to 8 years in prison for participating in what's now being classed as mass unrest.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. The Los Angeles Opera is to investigate claims of sexual harassment against one of the world's most famous opera singers, Placido Domingo. Eight singers and a dancer alleged they were harassed in a series of incidents dating back to the 1980s. Placido Domingo has denied the allegations, insisting he believed all his interactions and relationships were welcomed and consensual. Our correspondent Richard Galpin has more.
Placido Domingo has been described as one of the greatest opera singers of all time. He's performed around the world to packed audiences. But now at the age of 78, he faces allegations of sexual harassment from a group of nine women with whom he'd been working over several decades. Other women have alleged his sexual propositions had made them feel uncomfortable. The alleged sexual harassment was reportedly witnessed by opera staff, who've been quoted as saying he pursued younger women with impunity. But in a statement, Placido Domingo denied the allegations, saying they were inaccurate. He also said people who knew him or worked with him knew he was not someone who would intentionally harm, offend or embarrass anyone. He did say he recognised the rules and standards by which people are measured against today are very different than they were in the past. Following today's allegations, the Philadelphia Orchestra has withdrawn its invitation for Placido Domingo to perform with them next month.
Richard Galpin reporting. Later in this podcast,
there's women in woolly hats and warm coats, young people tapping on mobile phones, and everyone here has come to learn what to do if an earthquake strikes.
Practice evacuations in Chile to minimise the death toll in earthquakes. The United States is delaying additional tariffs of 10% on consumer goods from China, things like games and laptops, until mid-December. To find out more, I spoke to our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
President Trump has announced that there are going to be additional tariffs taking effect on the 1st of September. On the original plan was a tariff of 10% on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. Now, the decision has been taken to exempt some goods altogether on grounds of national security, health and safety, and others are the tariff imposition is being delayed by 3.5 months up till the middle of December, just before Christmas. And there is some speculation that Christmas is at least part of the underlying logic for some of these goods because it would it could prevent an additional price rise on some types of goods that will be very popular as Christmas gifts.
So Donald Trump doesn't want to do anything to interrupt the flow of the US economy in the run-up to the holidays?
I think that's part of what he's thinking, yes, although it must be said that there are significant lobbies within the United States that think the American economy is already suffering because of the tariffs. Many industries have already said that they're having to pay more for the raw materials, parts and so forth that they that they're buying from China. And on the other side, let's not forget there has been some Chinese retaliation, and American farmers have particularly been affected by that, by additional tariffs on, for example, soybeans. And so, yes, I think Mr. Trump has taken heed of the consultation exercise on these additional tariffs that are proposed to attempt to moderate the impact on the American economy. but some impact there has already been.
Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker. Cases of malaria have hit 1 million in the past 2 months in Uganda, according to the National Health Ministry, and that's up 40% compared with the same period last year. I asked our reporter Patience Atuhaire in Uganda what's causing this sudden surge.
In Uganda in particular, there are some regions which are traditionally colder in the east and in the southwest, which never used to experience malaria, the regions around the Rwenzori Mountains. And because these places are becoming warmer and warmer, like the rest of the world, malaria is beginning to show up in some of these places. But also for this particular year that we are looking at, the 40% increase relates to the fact that in 2019, Uganda has had like a prolonged rainy season. And because of the rain, malaria-transmitting mosquitoes are able to breed and therefore cause a higher risk for people.
And tell me about the malaria net, because malaria nets have a short shelf life.
Yes, they do, because malaria bed nets are made out of very delicate material, sort of like lace. So they wear out, they grow old, they get torn. In some families in rural areas, they'll, for instance, get, you know, eaten by cockroaches. And so they don't last a long time. If you've used a bed net for 2 years, it's probably about time to replace it.
And is there a plan to try and deal with this increase that we're discussing?
Well, the government has been quite proactive in the last few years, and especially with the distribution of mosquito nets and getting people to get to the hospital and get treated as fast as possible when they catch malaria. But also on the area of prevention, more people around the country and the rest of the region are more aware of the dangers of malaria and how they can avoid it. So there's been all this campaigning and all this big money from the USAID of this world and such organizations going into malaria prevention, education, research. And of course, the area of climate change, I think that's a big one. Some of these areas which have become warmer, for instance, there's going to have to be measures to sort of return them to their original climate, which is a bit mild. So that's quite a tough one. But small things like teaching people to clean around their houses, make sure there are no tall bushes, make sure there's no stagnant water, that has been done again and again.
Patience Atuhaire in Uganda. Chile is one of the nations hit by some of the most powerful earthquakes ever recorded. It was rocked by a major quake in 2010, 500 times more powerful than one in Haiti 6 weeks earlier. But whereas 200,000 people died in Haiti, there were only 525 casualties in Chile. The country has become a world leader in minimising the human death toll in earthquakes. It trains teams from around the world. The government's disaster agency runs regular practice evacuations and community training sessions across the country, as our reporter Grace Livingston's been finding out.
Locals have crammed into this community hall in the rural town of San Clemente. There's people of all ages here. There's women in woolly hats and warm coats, young people tapping on mobile phones, and everyone here has come to learn what to do if an earthquake strikes. Carlos Bernales, the regional director of the government's disaster agency, explains the aim of the course.
It's to provide the basic tools to communities to respond to post-emergency situations, so they can start search and rescue, put out small fires, provide first aid to people who are injured.
Chile is one of the most earthquake-prone countries in the world. People at this meeting know what it's like to live through an earthquake.
I was with my wife and some friends camping. I said, "It's shaking, it's shaking." The animals were bleating and howling, and the birds were screeching. It was incredible. The noise, then the dust, and the river. The water was the colour of chocolate. It was so murky.
My husband woke me up and just took me by the arm to the door. Then everything fell down. The floor collapsed. The ceiling fell in. I felt like the earth was opening up and I would be dragged down, that I was going to be buried.
The death toll in 2010 was low compared to other countries in the region. But nevertheless, 525 people died and 80,000 lost their homes. The government was determined to do better and set up community training programs all over the country. When another big quake struck in 2015, 1 million people were evacuated in record time and just 13 people died.
We've been given a task to build a tower out of paper and scotch tape in just 10 minutes. 5 minutes left.
The point of this exercise, with blaring music and people shouting, is to give a sense of the chaos in an emergency. Chile runs courses like this, not just here, but all over Latin America. I'm in Santiago now, and I've come to the headquarters of the government's disaster agency, which was designed by architect Teodoro Fernandez. He says Chile has very strict building regulations.
All buildings in Chile are resistant to earthquakes up to 8.5 or 9 points on the magnitude scale. It's a system of calculations about the structure. The building must be able to move and be resistant to pressure.
Should we go and have a look at the building?
Esto se mueve distinto que eso.
So this is what makes the building so earthquake-proof. It's called a seismic isolator, and basically it's four enormous pillars of concrete coming down onto a big bag of rubber.
Hola, mucho gusto.
Ricardo Toro is the national director of Chile's disaster agency. He knows firsthand the terrible consequences of inadequate construction. He was the acting commander of the United Nations forces in Haiti when an earthquake destroyed the UN building, killing more than 100 people inside.
My wife was visiting me in Haiti at this time, and the hotel where she was staying also collapsed, and she died in the earthquake. As all of the chiefs of mission had died in the United Nations building, I had to take charge. I had to deal with these two situations, to coordinate and address the problems of the first 72 hours, while on the other hand, deal with the anguish of losing my wife.
While Haiti was ill-prepared for that disaster, Chile is now a world leader in responding to earthquakes.
Grace Livingston reporting from Chile. Israeli women's rights groups are urging the mayor of Haifa to cancel a planned concert for a men-only audience by two popular ultra-Orthodox Jewish singers. The controversy comes after one of the artists cancelled another event when a court ruled that organisers couldn't force men and women in the audience to sit separately. Under a strict interpretation of Jewish laws, men and women are not supposed to mingle at social events. Yolande Nell sent this report from Jerusalem.
Mordecai Ben-David is often called the king of Jewish music. He's due to perform in Haifa later this month with a younger star of Hasidic pop, Motti Steinmetz. Their concert, which is getting city funding and support, is meant to be for men only. And that's the problem. A rights group, Israel Women's Network, says it amounts to illegal discrimination. Its objections have infuriated members of the ultra-Orthodox community. They come just days after legal action by the same organisation led to Motti Steinmetz pulling out of a concert in a public park in the city of Afula, because men and women might not be separated. A judge ruled that while Haredi audience members were free to seat themselves as they wanted, keeping to their religious customs, the event organisers couldn't force gender segregation on others. The decision sparked a heated political debate. One ultra-Orthodox politician described it as evil, while the head of a secular party praised it, saying Israel was not Iran. It's not uncommon for musical events in Israel to lay bare the religious-secular divide. 2 years ago, another conservative singer stirred up controversy by blindfolding himself with duct tape on stage to avoid seeing women dancing to his song. But with the ultra-Orthodox population here growing fast, it's not just its pop stars becoming more influential. Its religious leaders are too, and that's having a cultural and political impact.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem. Use less plastic, walk instead of taking the car, turn the light off when you leave the room. Just small ways we're all being nudged to change our behaviour as part of a global effort to combat climate change. When it comes to the food on our plate, well, that might be more difficult to stomach. One British university is making headlines by banning beef to help save the planet. Here's Jonathan Savage.
No mince, no burgers, and certainly no steak night.
beef is off the menu at Goldsmiths University in London. According to the UN, livestock accounts for 14.5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, and cattle for almost half of that. That's why the new warden of Goldsmiths, their word for the person in charge, has decided to take this step. Professor Frances Cormer says declaring a climate emergency cannot be empty words. She's backed by the Students' Union and its spokesman, Joe Leem.
Things like behavioural economics, such as, say, awful images on cigarette packets, work for things like that. Cigarette usage went down. But for something like a climate emergency, I think we need a much bigger intervention on a national and international level. You know, the fact that we've got to this point after over 20 years of politicians and scientists discussing climate change, it shows that we need a huge intervention.
Banning beef, of course, isn't that huge an intervention. But Goldsmiths is also charging a 12-cent levy on bottled water and single-use plastic cups. It plans to install more solar panels and switch to a 100% clean energy supplier. The beef ban has its critics. The UK's National Farmers Union says removing beef from menus is an overly simplistic approach and that British beef farming is much more sustainable than average. Nevertheless, some companies are finding it profitable to offer cattle-free alternatives, and not just when it comes to food. Dr. Martin's, the footwear company, has announced a 70% increase in profits, thanks in part to its new range of vegan boots, now amounting to 4% of the company's sales.
Jonathan Savage reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. And if you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address you need is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Music Life.
It's just to talk about our journeys and how we've got here and what music is to us.
Music Life. A crowd singing back to you. Yeah. That to me is the most satisfying thing.
Music Life.
My favourite thing about music is we can all listen to it and have a completely different experience.
Music Life.
You have to say, okay, right, I do mean this.
Music Life.
What's going on in this room right now?
A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
I want to talk about how this is ruining your life.
Bringing together musicians from across the globe.
I love this. Yeah, this is brilliant.
Talking to each other about how they make their music.
When you're just having a good time, you're the most free. There's less pressure to be like, all right, let me think of something that's going to blow everybody's mind.
And why they do what they do.
Everyone knows this track and is vibing to it. And that was just a special feeling.
Music Life.
I guess this is just my destiny.
Find the first 3 episodes now by searching for Music Life wherever you get your podcasts.